Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. Today's program is about the most successful prison break in Australian history, the Catalpa escape. On Easter Monday, 1876, six Irish prisoners were rescued from the world's toughest prison, Fremantle Jail, by a Quaker sea captain. His name was Captain Anthony, and today you get to meet his great-grandson. Fremantle Prison operated until 1991, and this escape story is now a symbol for all prisoners who passed through its gates and survived. First in the story, you'll meet Brendan Woods, who wrote and performed a stage show about the Catalpa in 2003. The show featured a lot of Irish music, and it played in Fremantle Jail, the very location where the Fenians were incarcerated. Consequently, the play became part of the prison history itself, and the story it told was not just about the Catalpa.
Celtic dreaming.
12.
Jesus, I'm even hopeless. Oh, I'm hopeless.
This is Brendan Woods playing me his music on a CD in the kitchen of his Perth home.
Isn't it terrible that I can't even manipulate? It's 10 12. Extremely low.
His CD tells the story of the Catalpa escape, which is what I've come here to discuss.
Play, isn't it? Just play.
When we can get the CD player working, you'll hear track 12. The words are that of John Boyle O'Reilly, and they were written when he was hiding in the bush, waiting for a whaling boat to rescue him from imprisonment. The musical arrangement is Brendan's.
When O'Reilly was in the bush, he was very observant of nature, and he claims that none of the birds actually sang like he was used to in Ireland, you know, with thrushes and things. And so he wrote this fabulous poem, and I put an Irish air and got didgeridoo and fiddle.
Land of the songless birds, what was
thy ancient crime, burning through lapse of time, like a prophet's cursing words?
Over the years, the story of the Catalpa escape has been told many different times, but it's still not as widely known as the story of Ned Kelly or the Eureka Stockade. Yet for some people, it's just as important, maybe even more important. Here's author Tom Keneally.
The Catalpa must be a grand finalist for one of the great escape stories. It's a story about men, Irish nationalists, locked up for life, and some of their comrades who've been freed developed the scheme of buying a Yankee whaler, which is like buying a 747, sending it round the world and rescuing them. It is to be regretted that old-fashioned sectarianism, the Irish versus the loyalist, has sat like a lump of cement on the story for so long. Now it's getting out, and one day soon, a novelist better than me and a young filmmaker will say, this has to be made, this has to be written.
Hi.
Liam Gallagher. Leah. This is Leah, the boss, my boss and the man.
Hang a moment. Get away, you.
Brendan and I are now in Fremantle Jail, and we're being given the keys. Even today, the keys carry a great weight of symbolism. We have to sign for them, and Brendan is trusted because he's a tour guide here.
Up you go, Brendan. Thank you.
I won't be long. I'll keep out of the way.
Yep.
Even though this prison was built in the 1850s, it was still being used in 1991. It was where, in 1964, Eric Edgar Cook was hanged, the last man to be hanged in Western Australia.
Hello. I'm supposed to be, we're doing a documentary for BBC, ABC Radio.
Very good.
I've come a long way, haven't I? Have you any Irish on the tour?
I think I've got a few of the Irish, yes.
Where are you from, love?
Galway.
Galway, oh my God. He's hard to understand because he's Australian. They speak funny in Australia. Isn't that right, girls? Now, Lynn, I'm going to show you a convict cell, exactly how it would have looked when the convicts, including the Fenians, were here. Now, have a look at that.
Okay, so what you've got is not a proper mattress. It's more a hammock.
Yes. No pillow, one blanket in summer, three in the winter. There's a collapsible table here and a chair. It's quite a clever way, you know, and that's where they'd have their meals, and that's if they were writing, you know, letters and things. They were allowed to write letters, but you're lucky if you get a letter twice a year. So inside here, you're locked up at about 6 o'clock in the convict days, and inside you had a metal bowl for your watery porridge, which was gruel, they called it, a mug for black tea, 8 ounces of stale bread. They were not allowed to have fresh bread because the doctor, the surgeon, said that the fresh bread would clog up their intestines and they wouldn't be able to do a hard day's work. But they had to stand out here, so you can imagine from here to the very end, they had 1,000 convicts at a time.
And there would be someone above you on the gantry up there and then someone on the next gantry as well.
And they'd have their toilet bucket because up to 1991, there was no running water. And one bucket per cell between two prisoners.
A noble Welsh ship and commander, called Catalpa, they say, sailed into Western Australia and stole 6 bold Fenians away. For 7 long years they had served here, and 7 long more had to stay, for defending their country, old Ireland.
This song about the Catalpa is banned in Western Australia, and we could get in trouble just for playing it.
First blazed a trail o'er the sea.
But it's very widely known, and its banned status is probably just an anachronism. I guess we'll find out.
You kept them in Fremantle prison till their hair had begun to turn grey, till a yank from the shores of New Bedford came out here and stole them away.
This particular rendition of the song is from Brendan's Catalpa-based stage show called Cashman's Diary. It was performed here in the prison a few years ago, and well-known journalist and author Estelle Blackburn was in the audience.
And here's to brave John Boyle O'Reilly.
It was an excellent night of theatre, particularly good and particularly moving because of the story. You weren't let off any of the drama of the poor guys being lashed and the howls and the screams and the blood, etc. We were certainly reminded of the horror of their life there in Fremantle Prison. And it was particularly brutal. Those days, they weren't very good to convicts or prisoners. And there we were sitting in the exact building where this had been happening to these guys years earlier, being entertained. The play was brutal in places. But here's a map of Fremantle Prison. It's on an invitation for the Cashman's Diary for the wonderful play.
And on the invitation it says, have a bite to eat or drink with Joe's Ice Cream Parlour, and by
special memento of Catalpa Day at the Gatehouse Gift Shop. So it is a strange, strange, contradictory place now with enjoy your ice cream and hear this horrible story.
Yes, you can't be in that atmosphere without hearing the ghosts.
And certainly. Now where do you buy your ice cream?
Yeah, that's right. The ice cream little cafe is just sort of in here-ish. That's a big open area. As soon as you go through the gatehouse, you pay your money there. And just to the left is the cafe and a bookshop just there.
Lovely.
And this cafe and bookshop, where you can buy prison-themed keyrings, fridge magnets, postcards, is the very same place where one of the incarcerated Fenians penned this desperate letter.
Dear friend, remember this is a voice from the tomb, or is this not a living tomb? In the tomb it is only a man's body that is good for the worms, but in this living tomb the canker worm of care enters the very soul. Think that we have been nearly 9 years in this living tomb since our first arrest, and that it is impossible for mind or body to withstand the continual strain that is upon them. One or the other must give way. It is to aid us in this sad strait that I now, in the name of my comrades and myself, ask you to aid us in the manner pointed out. We expect great aid from yourself, who knows us perhaps better than any other man in the organization. We ask you to aid us with your tongue and pen, with your brain and intellect, with your ability and influence. God will bless your efforts. We will repay you with all the gratitude of our nature. Our faith in you is unbounded. We think that if you forsake us, then we are friendless indeed. Remember that in the hour of our trial we flinched not, and be assured that whether you succeed or not, the greenest spot in our memory is connected with you, and that we never forget that we are still soldiers of liberty.
This letter became known as the Voice from the Tomb, and it was published widely but secretly in Irish-American circles to raise money for a rescue mission. It worked. Money flowed in, and over the next 2 years, a plan evolved.
One of the speakers brought up a really good point and said, in this day and age, it would be like somebody taking a 747, flying it somewhere, scooping the guys up and flying back and avoiding all the fighter pilots that want to blow them out of the air. Because it was really dramatic.
This is James Ryan, the great-grandson of the New England Quaker whaling captain who sailed the Catalpa on that voyage.
Cashman! O'Reilly! Dara! McDonald!
My God, O'Reilly, they're going to put us in with
Cranston.
That lot. Listen
Fitz
to them.
Gerald.
Sounds like the pick of hell in there.
Easy, Seamus. We'll manage. Try to keep together so we can look out for each other.
But the story needs some backfill at this point. The Catalpa is running away from us too fast. We need to know why these men were in jail. The Fenians were, in the eyes of the Irish, freedom fighters. And in the eyes of the English, they were traitors. These Fenians in particular, the ones in Fremantle Jail, were there because they'd deserted the British Army to join the Irish cause. As a punishment, they had the letter D branded on their chest, and they were never to be pardoned.
Except those 15 who were on treason charges. You are to be accommodated with the criminal prisoners.
The man who recruited these soldiers was John Boyle O'Reilly. He'd recruited them from his own regiment. Now he wanted to rescue them. He'd already served time in Fremantle Jail, but escaped via a whaling ship, and this seemed the best plan for his friends as well. A ship was bought and a sea captain found. His name, George Anthony. He'd never captained a whaling boat before.
In the late afternoon of April 29, 1875, Captain George Anthony grimaced as the skiff cut back across the shimmering dark blue waters of Buzzards Bay. The Catalpa's rigging shone with fresh tar and her pennant flags fluttered as her pristine white canvas sails billowed with the steady breeze rising from the southwest.
This is Peter Stevens' book called Voyage of the Catalpa. It's meticulously researched, and an important part of that research was chatting to James Ryan.
And Peter Stevens was really interesting. He asked me some great questions. I remember the one of the last questions he asked me before he left that night, and I'm telling you, we probably stayed up till 2 or 3 in the morning. He said, why did your great-grandfather do this? He didn't do it for money, we know that. He wasn't a patriot, he wasn't Irish. I said, well, I can only tell you what my grandfather told me. He told me it was the right thing to do. And Peter goes, that's awesome. And I think he put that in the book.
For several minutes, Anthony pondered his decision to take this ship and this mission. A New England Quaker and whaleman, he had signed on for a voyage across the globe to Western Australia, not to hunt whales, but to attempt the rescue of 6 Irish rebels from Fremantle Jail. At the moment, he was not even sure why he had accepted. Why, he wondered, was I gambling all for these Irish in a cause which was not my own? To be sure, there would be profit in it if we were successful, but a British noose or a cell if we weren't.
Come tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, McGugle, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon.
Let's hear this song after they've escaped. Freedom, the freedom, the dream that never dies.
Oh, the Cry of the Dreamer, that's his, that's another sad, sloppy one, and that's it.
That's Cashman. I used to trumpet on that.
You had fun getting musicians in, didn't you?
26 in all.
Which track are the bagpipes?
Fremantle Jail.
Ah, okay, that's...
No, but I'll come to that.
Come to that.
The Cry of the Dreamer. It's almost like 15.
I mean, this is why I think you like the story. It's a dream that never dies.
Correct, yeah.
In the crowded hives of men, heart weary of building and spoiling, and spoiling and building again.
And I mean, we all want freedom.
The dear old river.
Dear old river, where I dream.
You obviously don't miss Ireland, though.
No. Recession. I was just talking as a tour guide in the jail, which I am during the week. I keep getting news from home, as I say, any word from home? Yeah, recession. And all the Irish are out in West Australia working in the mines. So it was only yesterday, was it, or the day before, I said, well, what's it like? Well, we're from County Galway and there's 4 inches of snow and it's -2 during the day.
And here it's 32.
Yeah.
And there's mozzies.
Oh, yes, the mozzies are lovely. And bees.
From the sleepless thoughts endeavour, I would go where the children play, for that dreamer lives forever, and a tinker dies in a day.
The Catalpa's rescue mission could have failed at any moment. The whole journey was beset by problems. On the way, the boat lost half her crew, and she was 3 months late arriving. The plan was also nearly scuppered at the last moment by a rival rescue mission, and the authorities at the prison were alerted to the escape plan, but chose not to do anything about the information. Then on the actual day of the rescue, when Captain Anthony was hiding on Rockingham Beach, waiting for the prisoners to arrive by coach from Fremantle Jail, he was seen by a local who told the police where to look. The
gang only just made it onto the water in a small wooden rowboat when the full force of the British Army arrived on the beach.
What followed was 48 hours of harrowing drama that would challenge the rescuers' resolve to the very last.
In the traditions of good escape yarns, they get dreadful seas.
They rowed for 28 hours to get out to the Catalpa in international waters. He tried to appease the poor dispirited fellows on board, saying he's seen much worse than this. But in fact, he wrote later that he wouldn't have given a halfpenny for their lives.
Then the storm blows over. By some miracle, Captain Anthony and his Irish prisoners survive. They make it to the Catalpa. And then they have to face the police out at sea.
Towards morning, the sea died down to a heavy swell as the storm abated. They jury-rigged a small jib-sail to an oar and made reasonable headway. At dawn, they again sighted the Catalpa and tried to signal her. At that moment, the Georgette steamed into view, heading for the Catalpa.
Get that sail down! Everybody lie low in the boat. If we're lucky, they won't see us.
They've seen the Catalpa, though. They're headed straight for her.
Row, 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 boys, row. Never more to sail away. Bend your backs, bullies, boys, and row.
A determined British superintendent called Stone commandeered the Georgette, a steamer, armed it with a cannon, and when it was close enough, fired a warning shot. And this is the part of the story James Ryan likes the best.
I think that when he was being chased by the British, and they had trapped him, and they were waiting for his boat to kind of drift into the inside the 10-mile limit where they could capture them. I think that they fired the shot across his bow, and he goes, you know, if you fire on this boat, you fire on the American flag. That took a lot of courage. I think that to some extent, that to me was powerful because not only was he a peaceful person, but he also had a sense of purpose, and he stated it that way. He was strong. He was a good person, but he wasn't weak. You know, he had the guts to say that.
What for?
Wearing his battered cap and the salt-streaked dark blue greatcoat, Anthony stood nearly motionless for several minutes. His crew's eyes darted back and forth from their captain to the British ship.
May I come aboard?
No, sir!
I telegraphed your captain.
Anthony glared out across the water at Stone. Then, the New Bedford shipmaster raised the speaking trumpet to his lips.
He's bluffing. The lines have been tattooed.
And pointed up at the mainmast, at the stars and stripes. This ship is sailing under the American flag, and she is on the high seas, Anthony shouted. If you fire on me, I warn you that you are firing on the American flag.
Last warning! My flag protects me! And if you fire on this ship, you fire on the American flag!
Stone then blurted, but if there are escaped convicts on board, your flag won't protect you in that. Coolly, Anthony said, yes, it will, in international waters.
Will you let me come aboard?
No, sir! I am bound for sea and cannot stop.
Then your government will be communicated with after you take the consequences, Stone called out. You have 15 minutes.
In that 15 minutes, the wind changed and the Catalpa's sails filled with air, and suddenly she was no longer stuck but away. Superintendent Stone watched her go. It couldn't have been a narrower escape.
A noble whale ship and commander was called the Catalpa, they say. Sailed out to Western Australia
and took six Bohemians away.
Come all you screw warders and jailers, remember the Brigada Day. Take care of the rest of your feelings, or the Yankees will sail them away.
For
7 long year they had served here, and 7 long more had to stay. For defending their country, old Ireland, for this they were banished away. Come all you screwwaters and jailers, remember Perthriga today. Take care of the rest of your opinions, or the Yankees will steal them away.
And there's that lovely contrast between, you know, the mad Irish Fenian plan, and then there's the strong discipline of a Quaker sea captain managed to rescue them.
And that's what's great about it, because it's just like, how do I want to say this? I really think that there's something to be said for quiet people doing great things at least once or twice in their lives.
When Brendan and his friend Sean toured the Catalpa show, Cashman's Diary, to North America, James Ryan heard about it by chance, really.
He only saw it in the local paper, and he brought his wife and children to the show. It was a two-man, you know, I'm singing, Sean is doing, we're telling stories and backdrop video, you know, whatever. And afterwards he came up and he said, can I buy one of your CDs? And I said, yeah. And then he says, can you sign it for me? And of course I was quite, you know, even, I didn't know at this stage who he was, but even to be asked to sign a CD, I mean, wow. And he says, what are you doing later? So he invited us up to the house. Beautiful, beautiful, big New Bedford wooden house. Huge. And we had a few beers and some lovely soup. That is the soup first and then the beers. And James brought me up to the attic. And he says, come up and I'll show you some of my collection.
But for Brendan, James Ryan's Catalpa collection would have remained hidden in his attic. Here's James's version of the story.
This friend of mine called me, and he said, listen, they're doing a thing on the Catalpa at the Whaling Museum. Would you like to go? He said, I think it's going to be pretty cool. It's going to be a play called Cashman's Diary. And I said, yeah, I'd love to go. So took my wife, and we went there, and there were T-shirts they were selling outside, so I bought a couple of T-shirts. And there was a CD, so I bought a CD. We went and sat down, and we watched the play, and Brendan was playing and singing. And when it got over, I was really kind of touched. And so I went down, and I said, hi, I want to thank you. This is a wonderful production. He goes, well, what's your interest in the Catalpa? I said, oh, my great-grandfather was the captain of the Catalpa. He stops. He's like so animated. He jumped up, and he calls these people out of the audience, and down comes Peter Stevens. And standing next to me, and he said, I'll never forget Brendan's line. He goes, you got any stuff? I said, yeah, what do you mean by stuff? Well, any Catalpa stuff. I said, yeah, I got a lot of Catalpa stuff. Why? He goes, can I come to your house tonight and see it? And I said, sure, I'd be more than glad to take you to the house and show you.
And when the two met, they were so excited, they videoed the moment. Here they are performing to the camera inside James's New Bedford home.
It's a beautiful picture, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah.
Side of the, oh, it's wonderful, yes. And this, Brendan, this is the flag, the American flag, one of them that flew over the Catalpa. I wanted you to see it and hold it yourself and get a sense of what it was like.
Wow. My gosh, and the length of it, look, it spreads out so much.
And you got to touch that flag?
In my hands, all the four flags that were hanging up on the thing, I held them in my hand, yeah. Shivering.
And what else have we got here?
Well, I have... This is Captain Anthony as a young man, approximately after, probably a couple of years after the expedition.
Yeah, you can see the similarity between you and him.
I had some old log books, had a lot of... newspaper clippings about the Catalpa. I had original pictures of the Fenians. I had what else did I have?
This is the barometer that was on the Catalpa.
Well, I suppose he never would have got home if this wasn't working properly.
I wonder what the reading was the day that he was pulling back from Rockingham Beach. I wonder how low it was because the weather was so poor.
The weather was so bad, that's right. And this here was his little set of...
Yes, these are the materials he used.
I mean, I have things, speeches that were written by my great-grandfather and stuff like that, things that people haven't seen before, as well as, you know, like other flags and, you know, other materials from the Catalpa. I could go on and on. I have everything from belaying pins to, you know, his personal chest that he, you know, he took when he went whaling.
You know what I'd really like to show you? I'd really like to show you the bills of sale to the Catalpa.
I just wanted to show it to you, so you could see it.
And then when they sold the Catalpa years later, would they have got their money back or
no.
whatever? They would have lost all their money.
They lost a lot of money on that, yeah, because they ended up, John T. Richardson sold it, used it for a while longer, and then sold it to a company that made it a coal barge, and then it was sunk in Belize. There's James Randall's signature right there.
Yeah. And what have we got here? His business card.
Yes.
Was it a story that you would have heard at school if you hadn't heard at home?
Absolutely not. And that's what's so interesting about it. I thought it was just like a family secret and that, you know, I knew about it. There was a big oil painting in my front hall. Nobody said every time I walked by it, look at that beautiful painting. It was just there. And I didn't think anything of it because it had always been there. It was just a really, you know, my family was so full of history, I just took it for granted, I guess. And it wasn't until I met Brendan that I realized how incredibly important this seems to be in other parts of the world, Ireland and Australia.
Is a picture of the men just before they land on the Catalpa, after the rescue.
It says here, the race for the Catalpa, the race was between the police cutter coming here.
And the boat and the Catalpa. Catalpa's trying to cut this boat off and get these men on board.
And the Georgette, of course, steaming up.
Yeah, and the Georgette's going to head this way and come over here, and actually they do fire a volley across the front of the boat. Mm-hmm. Right.
Shit. Look at this. Absolutely.
So those are the pictures, and this is my pride and joy. This is a watercolor of the Catalpa. This is the centerpiece of my
collection. Yeah.
I love this.
Beauty, isn't it?
It's a peaceful, wonderful picture for me. Right.
Isn't it amazing to find out that these are all here in the chest?
Yep. I think that I'm so fortunate because my relatives saved so much of this material, and I feel like it's for me, it's my obligation to share it with people like you who have such a great interest in it.
An addiction would be better than an interest, but well, it's...
Whatever it is, I'm really pleased that you and I found each other somehow.
Oh, that's nice, too. And the seagulls, gosh, it's absolutely wonderful.
We're now back in Perth, back in Brendan's kitchen with the temperamental CD player, listening to the music that was part of his show.
But I don't know whether I played this for you yesterday with the sound effects.
Okay, let's see.
You know, when we're talking about... What's that? What number is that? That's one. Find it, number 10. And another way. Isn't it terrible that I can't even manipulate?
And I'm left feeling after this journey round the globe that this is a resurrection story, that the men in the living tomb were brought back to life. So you had a nice time making this?
Getting sound effects and down at the sea. Sky
along. Around her as her course she steers across the torrid zone. Way until the North Star fades, the Southern Cross is high, and myriad gems of brightness beam are sparkling in the sky.
The tropic wind. This is why it's a complicated story. And it's why Brendan's play left a double impression on Estelle Blackburn. Estelle is known for her work in overturning wrongful convictions, and two of the wrongful convictions she worked on were those of prisoners in Fremantle Jail.
Yes, I've done some work to prove innocent two men who were incarcerated in Fremantle Prison in the 1960s. And it was certainly much better then than in the Fenian time, but still very, very cruel, very cold, very horrible for them too. After the Fenians had left, another section of the prison was built called the New Division, and Death Row is in the New Division. And although they weren't sent to the gallows, every prisoner who was sent to his death walked past that theatre, so you could I could almost see the ghosts of other condemned men walking past on their way to be hanged in the gallows as well.
Best cells in the house on the bottom over here.
With these two, John Button, he was wrongfully convicted of running down his girlfriend and was charged with willful murder, and spent time on death row until his trial, found guilty of manslaughter and given 10 years with hard labour. So he was then moved to the main division and he was in a cell on the third row. Daryl Beamish was convicted of the willful murder, a dreadful axe murder, of a woman who'd moved to Perth from Melbourne and condemned to death. So his family had heard those terrible words of the judge with the black cap on his head. He was a deaf mute, so he didn't hear them, but he was then in death row, not having a clue what was happening. When do I work? When do I see my girlfriend? Not any idea of what was happening to him. But because of his disability, even though they were happy hanging days in Western Australia in the 1960s, it was commuted to life imprisonment, and then he too was moved to the main division. So those two innocent men did spend a lot of time in the main division of Fremantle Prison. And although the cells had been doubled in size, they were still small, and they would have suffered exactly as the Fenians in terms of the heat and the cold.
I'll record the steps, they're good.
Yeah, okay. I should have worn boots. Now, Lynn, we're heading upstairs to show you where the Fenians would have been and also to the Catholic Church. So mind your step. Just imagine, these steps are 150 years old, made of solid jarrah.
Again, the emotion of going to see that solitary confinement cell, as I did, and I've walked from there, I've taken the steps to the gallows and had a good look at the gallows and even gone down to the bottom of the pit in terms of my innocent men who could well have dropped to the bottom of the pit. But also, I'm certain those Fenians would have heard the screams of nightmares, their own plus others, right through the prison at night, but also of they would have heard the executions going on as well as the floggings.
So where are we now?
We're directly under the Catholic Church in this little theatre is called the Crown Theatre. Awfully posh.
In the early days, they put on plays in here that were acted by the body inmates for...
I mean, what better place to have... and it was a musical production.
Yes.
Here in the jail to tell the story where the Fenians were.
Yeah, unbelievable atmosphere because you can get all the effects of particularly the jail and the ships, and we had sound effects and things like that.
Perhaps one of the most emotional moments for me was when I took John Button to the prison to get for my research, for him to tell me about his years there from 1963 to 65, and I was given a whole set of keys to go and wander freely through the prison, which by then was a tourism establishment. But when I threw this set of keys to John Button, saying, OK, show me the place... And the look on his face when he held in his hands the keys that he'd heard rattling around, that locked behind him, had to wait to open any door for him, knowing he was never getting out of that place, or not for 10 years, for him to suddenly have these keys in his hand and see the look on his face was perhaps one of my most moving moments in that prison. And to go back into his cell. So, well, which was your cell? Showed him his cell, and he walked back into his cell for the first time. That was interesting as well, for him to just stand there where he'd spent this time. Previously, he'd told me that all night he just paced up and down his cell, and he said it was 7 paces. When I got in there, I said, well, I pace. I said, it's only about 5 or 6, John. He said, well, I used to take 7. I wasn't in any hurry to get anywhere.
What's that bell?
That's the prison bell. The clock that rings every hour. So you hear stories from prisoners. You know, we get a lot of ex-prisoners who come, you know, just come around, and maybe some of them bring their kids, and, you know, maybe they've changed their life and just want to see. And I remember talking to this guy, and just as you were talking, the bell rang. And he says, "Don't remind me of that bell when it's 4 o'clock in the morning and you can't sleep with the heat and Mozzie's gone around the place and all you can hear is that stupid bell telling you it's 4 o'clock."
Particularly for the Fenians, when they really did, they were young men prepared to give their lives for liberty, for what they really believed, the liberty of their home country. They were there suffering all those years for that, seeing other Fenians being forgiven by Queen Victoria, only that she only insisted on the military. At some time, she then allowed the release of all the other Fenians, but the military ones, the ones that had joined the British Army in an attempt to, yeah. They were. So many of the people, the Irish people that were their friends, I suppose, in the prison, had been released. They'd seen them freed, and yet they were stuck in this living tomb.
Okay, let's hear the bagpipes. Ever sits and drawn wild alarm. Track 8. Where ocean in his anger shakes
aloft. I think they have to goggle backwards. Oh, that's a school clock. That's the next one. I should have let it go. Oh no, I'm going. There's another verse. Yeah, you should know this by now. You're the controller.
It'll be beautiful. That's the didge one.
No.
There's a bagpipes.
Two didges.
Two didges.
Here's the bagpipes coming in. Weirdest combination ever, didgeridoo and bagpipes. Now, the didgeridoo was to signify Aboriginal souls that went through Fremantle Jail. The bagpipes is to signify the Irish, and the mixture together.
Who did the arrangement?
I did. With Eric. I just say we want this,
Fremantle,
we want that.
Jail, you can still hear the wail of spirits.
Do you remember this poem by heart now?
Oh, yeah.
Gallows are quiet and leery half light.
No longer a gateway to hell. Concrete claws ensnared the men who stepped off the path on the right. Your 12-foot
walls muffle the calls of souls in the lonely night. For 100 years... and 1 billion tears, you encapsulated men. Some would come, some would go, some lives in there would end. Few metal doors clang anymore, the guard posts are all unmanned.
So I got this Aboriginal guy to play didge, and when we were doing the video, when we came to the jail, he froze. He says, "I was in here in 1965 for 6 months for driving without a license." And then he dressed up in all the traditional costume, and you'll see him playing the didge on it. You know, it's hard, yeah. But I he was a great guy, and then suddenly when it came in, he said, that was my cell up there. 6 months for driving. You know, he was only a young kid, he was only 16 or 17. But, yeah, it's tough.
In Fremantle Jail, you can still hear the wail of spirits from any cell. and the gallows are quiet in the eerie half-light. No longer a gateway to hell.
The condemned cell particularly has open bars, just like you see in America. And they had a warder sitting outside the bars watching what the condemned man was doing 24 hours a day and writing it down in a book called the Occurrence Book. Every 10 minutes, someone was writing what the condemned man was doing.
Picks his nose.
Yeah, that sort of... Exactly. I managed to get hold of the Occurrence Books for the 13 months that Eric Edgar Cook spent in there. He was the last man who went to the gallows in Fremantle Prison. And exactly, there's 10-10 lying down, 10-15 turns to the right, turns to the left, no change, asks for toilet paper, opens his bowels, closes his bowels, returns toilet paper, etc. You've got not any privacy whatsoever. So, yeah, it was just a bucket in the cell. So there they're writing down every time you use the bucket for whatever, and every time you open a book, close a book, turn to the left in bed, turn to the right... Totally observed for and noted every 10 minutes. So from the condemned cell, they had to walk through. Yes, they walked through the main cell, past the theatre, and then out the back to the gallows just here. And the solitary confinement is another building that's not marked here, right at the back here. About 6 cells in solitary confinement, plus the flogging triangle just out here. And condemned men were woken at 6 o'clock. All the cells were closed. They were walked right through here out to the solitary confinement. They spent their last 2 hours in solitary confinement cell with the minister. And then when they walked to the gallows, it was only about 30 steps from the solitary confinement through to the gallows. At that point, it was over very quickly. And all the prisoners were sent out to sit in the yards. But they always knew the moment of the prisoner's death because all the pigeons that had settled on the gallows would fly up with the noise.
What's the most heartbreaking one for you on this? What track?
Heartbreaking would be my singing partner, Sean. It's the White Rose.
Shall we find that?
Yeah, that should be next.
No play, it recommends.
What's this one?
This is the White Rose. It contains the White Rose and the Red Rose.
This is another of Brendan's compositions, and the words are from John Boyle O'Reilly. As you can hear, as well as being a convict escapee and a deserter from the British Army, he was a writer, a loyal friend, and a lover.
Going into minor keys.
Yes, as usual.
And the white roses are dove. But I send you a cream white rosebud.
When did he write the words for this?
I think possibly in Boston, but we don't know, but in my play... I use it with Jesse. You know, Jesse, I use it in there, but there's no actual date on it. But I'd probably taken...
Liberties,
but it's just the words, the clever way he uses the roses. It's coming again. The white rose and the red rose, but he's saying the cream rose.
Whispers of passion. And the white rose blooms of love.
Does it make you cry every time?
Yeah, it's Sean. We sang together for 14 years toured America. He's living in Ireland now. But it's just his voice. You know, I wrote it kind of for him, stretching them out.
But I send you a cream white rose bud. With a flush on its petal tips, for the love that is purest and sweetest has of desire on the lips.
The White Rose, from a CD called John Boyle O'Reilly and the Fenian Escape from Fremantle Jail. Thanks to Estelle Blackburn and James Ryan for participating in today's program, which was produced by Lynn Gallagher, with technical production by Angie Grant. For more information about the Catalpa Escape and Fremantle Prison, check out the Hindsight page on the Radio National website at abc.net.au/radionational and look for Hindsight in the drop-down box. Next week on the program, the story of a Swedish diplomat and World War II hero, Raoul Wallenberg, who saved the lives of up to 100,000 people during the Holocaust, some of whom ended up in Australia.
Raoul Wallenberg's sister, Nina Lagergren, receives me in her apartment in a fashionable part of Stockholm. The rooms are filled with photographs, paintings and books of her brother Raoul. Nina is well over 90. Her daughter has warned me she's frail, but Nina can't refuse a request to talk about her brother. She shows me an old leather-bound photo album. The first image is of a house in Kapstad.
Det är Kapstad.
Oj.
Som är så du har varit där.
Varför jag springer där på dagen.
Jaha. Ja, springer
förbi.
This is the house. Raoul was born in Kapstad. He used to run in the woods. You know how dangerous it is to run there. In this photo, he was only 3, and his mother was only 20, a young widow. He was often left on his own to roam along the beach.
Peter Forrester is the son of a Hungarian Jew that Raoul Wallenberg saved. Peter lives in Australia.
I mean, I was absolutely taken by the story. I was just amazed at the concept of anybody, let alone Raoul Wallenberg, but anybody who was not of the same religion, who was not of the same race, who had no motivation other than pure decency and morality and goodness to put his own life at risk to save the life of my father. And I found this story absolutely captivating. And then on top of that, to find out then that Raoul's fate had been so tragic, I was very, very moved by the entire episode.
Indeed, Wallenberg's story contains a deep and tragic mystery. He disappeared in 1945. Was he mistakenly killed by the liberation forces at the end of the war, or did he die decades later in a Soviet gulag? Join us on Hindsight next week to find out about the life of Raoul Wallenberg. I'm Lorena Ellam. My thanks today to Louis Mitchell. The news is next here on RN.